Today on Wings, speakers address the tricky economics of militarization and climate change during Plenary 2 of the 12th Annual Forum of AWID, the Association for Women's Rights in Development.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. 2,240 registrants from 140 countries gathered in Istanbul, Turkey in April 2012 to discuss transforming economic power to advance women's rights and justice. Speakers in Plenary 2 addressed some tricky subjects that form the context of economic power. Here's Amina Mama on militarization.
Good morning, everybody. I've been asked to share some thoughts and pose some questions around militarism and the global economy. And I think a good title would be Perils and Profits. And I think one of the major points I will do is look at how militarism functions at the core of modern statecraft and political economies in ways that it is critical for feminists to address, engage, challenge, actually overthrow. Let me not pull punches. Why is militarism important? Briefly put, the last century really could have been described as a century of war, with over 250 formally declared wars and over 100 million lives lost. That was the last century. What do we face in the 21st century? The challenges have evolved, and even if many of us come from states that were once military states, referred to as colonial states, formed through an unholy triad of trading, mercantilism, ideological inputs, and economic inputs. And actually, when you look at it, you can't separate these different components out. In other words, the material and the economic and the bodies involved are in a deep engagement with the ideologies, the cultures, the subjectivities, the gender identities. So it's very complex terrain. Apart from the declared wars, undeclared wars in the form of political repression, genocides, attacks carried out against various communities, targeted by state forces, non-state militias, have claimed millions more than what we understand within the formal calculus of costs of war. I don't know if those figures count the colonial conquests and our liberation movements. I don't know if they count the participation of many colonized peoples in imperial wars. Perhaps they should. There's a lot of data to show, for example, just in French West Africa, 175,000 French West African conscripts who had no choice fought in the First World War. The Second World War, the same. Vast numbers of, in this case, Africans deployed all over empire as servants of imperialism, soldiers of imperialism. None of this calculus about the history of war or about the extent of war and the involvement in it is complete. The data is very, very selective and focuses on armies and states and border conflicts. In the 21st century, things look very different. As feminists, we are particularly interested in the biggest ongoing undeclared war that is most familiar to us. Again, there's data which can't begin to evoke the meaning of 200 million women estimated to be missing worldwide. People used to think this was mostly about amniocentesis. That's a little piece of it. 40 to 70% of women's deaths are the result of intimate partner violence. This is a war within the household, within the most intimate arenas of life, far apparently from battlefields. So what do these facts, these simple facts, imply for how we understand war and militarism, how we understand peace, the meaning of peace, security? Everyone here is familiar with the gendered nature of violence. And we need to spend more time looking deeply into how militarism works as a gendered process, central of what is defined as modern statecraft, and how that is changing in the global economy of today with deregulation, the diminution of the state, and conflicts taking very, very different forms, embedded in communities. It's no longer men on battlefields. Indeed, it hasn't been just that for a long time. But as feminists, we have very good reason to recognize the fact that this is not just about boys with toys. It's not just about men and guns. It actually affects all of us and draws all of us into normalized webs of complicity. Wherever we're located, whether as taxpayers, as American citizens, looking after their own security by mounting wars in distant places, however we look at this, it has its ideological and cultural aspects. And this is what the idea of militarism does. It goes way beyond arms expenditure and the numbers into how this gets embedded and sustained in a society, in the culture, in the fashions, in the clothing, in the gendered identities of men and women. Forged in the context of militarism, these become extreme and extremely polarized. Militarization is a divisive, ethnicizing, classed, and gendering process. It's a key site for the reproduction of the worst forms of masculinity, violent masculinities. Indeed, the gender relations have changed rather dramatically. And one of the biggest things we're seeing now is the very, very high involvement of women and children in warfare. And the casualty rates have shifted from being nearly 1 to 9 civilian to military. Majority of people used to be soldiers. Nowadays, conflicts are costing 90% civilian casualties. So there's a big shift in the kinds of war that are being fought, the kinds of weapons that are being used. But I'm going to focus now on the economic aspects of this, which are vast. I mean, I've only begun looking at the global economy recently. With my colleagues, we have started looking at it at the level of women's livelihoods. So we must apply a feminist economic analysis to understand this phenomenon. And that makes us look at the macro picture, these huge spending figures, the relationship between military and social spending being inverse, and the fact that the other economic side of it is the microeconomy, the household economics, the problematic idea of the care economy. But all of this is, if you like, the organic base, the infrastructure that sustains war. So in war zones and conflict zones, women's labor is radically altered by the facts of militarization and conflict. And then there's all the details of how this affects gender relations in communities in terms of how women and men can pursue means of survival in combat zones, in heavily militarized zones that persist long after the formal declaration of peace. In fact, as feminists, we would look specifically at the fact that in post-conflict contexts, rape figures continue to rise. The violence doesn't just wither away. I grew up in Nigeria in the early civil war. The society has never, never stopped being violent. And we're not just talking about the military. We're talking about the pervasion within civil society, within what we call the contractocracy. If we think that colonialism was enabled by militarism, then the post-colonial era is one in which development and militarism are completely antithetical and completely antithetical to women's rights, any possibility of women's involvement. So it's the extreme institutionalization of patriarchy. And it's part of a global system that is very much fueled. If we think about where are the profits and who profits, where are the perils, and who's dying, who's being dislocated, whose livelihoods are being perverted and distorted, we begin to see the global configuration, which is very, very stark. And the fueling of militarism in the South, I mean, we always say in Africa, we do not make guns, but the continent is awash with guns. So this thing is being fueled from elsewhere, and figures are abundant. In the 5 years, 91 to 95, the US alone provided $227 million of military assistance to Africa in 50 countries. And many of these countries are the world's poorest. The U.S. government provides military aid to some of our worst dictators. And back in the 80s, there was actually a belief in some of the echelons of power that actually militarism facilitated development, unbelievable as it may seem. So the current world is very much the growth of military expenditure is familiar to all of us. We're talking war costs in the U.S. $3.2 to $4 trillion. The figures have gone off the scale, and that's just the numbers. We won't say what the U.S. is doing with that huge expenditure, but they are responsible for almost half of the entire global expenditure. But what I want to also draw attention to is the hidden economy, because, first of all, globalization has diminished the state and its reach and deregulated and enabled non-formal networks to proliferate. And this is not just, you know, people doing survival. Informal conjures up romantic notions of small-scale traders and so on. But here we're talking about huge cartels, networks that move from the woman who runs away from her village with a diamond hidden in her teeth and trades it in the marketplace to buy food for her family. She then is participating all the way up in the networks of power, which are very unequal, but ends up being caught up in the chains. Follow the money. It goes into various levels and layers of these complicated criminal networks. And the problem is that they're not just criminal, because the same hierarchized networks which people in local areas are completely subordinated to are linked into the global centers of power. The diamond traffic is a classic example. But we could talk about any of the resource-rich areas of the world that have remained imbued with conflict. And it's about the large part of it is about the operations of these networks. We need to begin to track this stuff. We need to track them down and isolate them and realize that this is a very integrated counter-economy, and we need to reckon with and work out how do we therefore act against the economies of militarism when almost everyone is imbricated in them in one way or another. We need to disentangle these dynamics and expose them. At the big level, the corruption that is called corruption in our countries, but actually what we're talking about is these huge corporations. The private sector has also moved into the military business. So a lot of generals retire and set up private companies, and the scandals around companies like Halliburton and Lockheed are hitting the press all the time. The contractocracy in Afghanistan, the fact that a well that may cost $100 to dig ends up costing over there $10,000. So the exposure of many of these things is ongoing. So 20% of the world's financial deposits are offshore. About 40% of all diamonds are smuggled. Post-war economies, Angola is 90% informal. So what do these official statistics and measures of the economy tell us? You're only measuring 10% of that economy in all the official computations. If the arms traffic we know about is huge, the illicit traffic is 500 billion, same amount as the illicit drug traffic, and then we know about sex trafficking. So women may be invisibilized, but in post-conflict economies, entire economic infrastructures in which people are now entrapped and upon which they rely are actually far stronger, far more influential. So what do we do with these kinds of networks? How do we track them down? There's actually more information than we might expect online and available. We just need to dig it out. But many of us choose to work at the subsistence end where majority of women are located, displaced, livelihoods disrupted, and actually facing extremely bad prospects after war. In fact, with women, the war is pretty much on a continuum, whether it's peace or war or conflict. The gender dynamics that are very much sharpened by outright fighting are nonetheless there in the build-up and in the aftermath. And we see this in terms of where women's labor is placed. The 30 to 40% women fighters in the contemporary wars are often actually pursuing the only livelihood available to them in the context of violence, and the post-war policies and strategies are simply missing them. Demobilization and security sector reform is primarily in the hands of security institutions. So women have been mobilizing, last point, okay, widely and across the world for centuries, but transforming and dismantling militarism really requires that we pursue what is going on in war from a microeconomic and a macroeconomic perspective, and out of that form the strategies. Meanwhile, women are organizing themselves in networks for survival, but I don't think this is going to be enough unless we begin to tackle the macroeconomic picture, most of which is still hidden from us at the same time. So the last questions that we should be thinking about is returning to my first question: who profits and who is imperiled by the current configurations of power and the salience, renewed salience of militarism in the 21st century? Thank you.
That was Amina Mama from Nigeria, speaking on militarization at the AWID Forum in Istanbul, Turkey. Amina Mama is the founding editor of the scholarly journal Feminist Africa. She chairs the board of the Global Fund for Women and directs the Women and Gender Studies program at the University of California at Davis. Another speaker on the second day's plenary was Chi Yok Ling from China. With the world's nations poised to hold in June of 2012 a new United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, sometimes called Rio+20, Chi Yok Ling described how a massive civil society movement achieved the Sustainable Development Framework Agreement in 1992, and how that consensus has been attacked and dismantled by economic forces.
In the last day and a half, a number of words have come out to describe this crazy situation that our planet and our peoples are in today. Two actually struck out for me: vicious and dehumanizing. Vicious and dehumanizing. And what is very interesting, of course, is that there was this moment in recent history that there was a sense at the level of those who represent us in our individual states. And that was the few years that led up to the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio. Because the period leading up to Rio was when the scientific evidence was culminating and scientific consensus was growing. There is this thing called global warming. And interestingly enough, it was in the heart of the United States where there was a very extensive drought that was felt in a very powerful way by the people of the United States that created a big part of the political momentum for the United States administration, which was Bush at that time, to actually negotiate in the United Nations. At the same time, the massive loss of biodiversity, especially the forests, the loss of biodiversity on land where people live on, and this is the struggle of the indigenous peoples against the ravage against the forests through logging, through dams, through mining. And so the culmination of the protests across the tropical south, from Malaysia to the Amazonia, the support of consumers, school children, unions across the world, civil society groups, made the cry of the loss of forest and biodiversity and the violation of the human rights of the people who live in the forest become a very important political agenda at the United Nations. Some of us were part of that movement that collected millions and millions of signatures from across the world, from thumbprints of indigenous peoples in the deepest forests to school children in Belgium and other parts of Europe. And we used wheelbarrows of all these signatures that were collected through a global campaign. And we took them to the United Nations and we demanded to see the Secretary General at that time, and they wouldn't come out to see us. And we said, you have a charter which says we the peoples. And we have all these signatures from all over the world. You got to see us because we demand that the United Nations do something about the loss of forest and biodiversity and human rights. So eventually, the Secretary General came up and met us, took our petition. And I say this because that really was for civil society groups and especially for organizations from the South, because the United Nations opened up, not just to the states, but to civil groups, to groups. We were consumer groups, women's rights groups, human rights groups, children's groups, religious groups, Baha'i, anything, people who come together around issues that they care for. And we all went towards the United Nations conference, and in every preparatory meeting, more and more people came, and they engaged with the United Nations, but more importantly, we engaged with the delegations of people who represent us from our different countries. The issues of colonialism, historical responsibility, the debt, not just the debt in terms of financial debt, which already had its own huge campaign because Africa was so strangled by IMF conditionality and the debt and everything. And they all came together around ecological debt, justice issues. And so we had, ultimately, heads of states, presidents and prime ministers and some kings, adopt this declaration that has as some of its more fundamental principles, equity, common but differentiated responsibilities. Recognizing that those who are rich, that benefited from the Industrial Revolution, did it in a very unsustainable manner, accumulated lots of wealth, had consumption and production patterns that are totally unsustainable, and therefore must take the lead for the transformation. And that other countries coming into this so-called development process would not follow the same destructive path, which will mean that we have our own obligation to restructure our economies, but because of that history of colonization and domination, there was a compact globally that those who benefited from the profiteering must now return, not aid, but returning the debt. And these were the fundamental principles that were adopted at the highest level politically. The polluter pay principles, precautionary approach, and recognizing in so many of the principles of that declaration, women, children, the diversity of peoples of the world. The right to development was reaffirmed, but within the context of sustainability. And that's a very important document. And at the same time, we saw this unprecedented, we could not imagine today, that you could have something like that and this thing called Agenda 21. Looking back, it seems so good. Then many of us were very, very critical because it didn't go far enough. But at least it was a recognition, and somewhere in Agenda 21, there's a phrase that says you need a paradigm shift. But what happened? In the last 20 years, we have seen broken promises, violated commitments, unfulfilled obligations. And all the more, we should be saying these instruments are not enough, we must do more. But no, actually, it's being dismantled. Because to deal with climate change, you really have no choice but to transform economic life and to really shift structurally how we're going to look at every aspect of how we run our world. So what we see now is first, the Kyoto Protocol is actually killed. It's dead. It's on intensive care, but it's actually not too alive. And there's been such a lot of misinformation that these two treaties, the UN Convention and the Kyoto Protocol, is not enough. It's not enough because the rich countries have to do things, developing countries don't have to do anything, and now we have these new Brazils and Chinas and Indias, and they should be treated exactly like the industrialized countries and do the same amount. Throw away equity, throw away all the principles that we agreed to use so that we can all do our part. And this is being fought out this year particularly because not only is the Kyoto Protocol already under attack and barely alive, the next attack will be on the UN Convention itself. Because in Durban, which was the last negotiation of the parties, the chief negotiator of the United States said, I cannot take back the word equity to Washington. I cannot take equity back to Washington. I do not believe that this is something that American citizens agree with. And so the issue of governance is very important. We need to have everybody realize that equity is under tremendous attack. And the negotiations will resume towards what all this means. There's a lot of push in the current assessment report that's being done to look at indicators. And a lot of things have been done, but there's been no proper framework. It's really crucial that the feminist movement and women's rights groups that are looking at this in a way that very few others are looking at, bring the analysis into the advocacy arena. And the road to Rio 2012 is one where what we see fought out in the climate change treaty is already expanded. The greenwashing of the green economy, commodification of nature, carbon markets becoming a solution to atmospheric catastrophe. Commodifying is bad enough, but then we see financialization. All the instruments that were used that created the financial crisis, derivatives, equity bonds, futures, speculation, things that we don't understand because they don't link to reality anymore. And we saw that happening with the financial crisis. The same instruments are now being proposed to deal with biodiversity financing and to create new mechanisms in climate change to raise money. Why? Because there is no money to fund sustainability. Just as they say always, there's no money for women's rights programs to be implemented. But there's money for militarism, and there's money that keeps going on and on for corporate greed and stranglehold. And so because there is no money in the public domain, which we have given up to the private sector and continue to drain away to the private sector, the big corporations, we therefore must turn to the market mechanisms to give us more financing for climate change and for sustainable development. It's insane. So one of the things that many of the groups have been fighting for is to say that we have to reaffirm those basic principles that got political consensus in 1992. And how do we then share in a fair and equitable manner the burden of the transition and that transformation within countries and between countries? Because if we don't have a fair and equitable and human rights approach, then what we will see is the desperation of the competitive model that will take the last of the resources, because those who have, who control, who have the power because of the control, will not give it up. And they will not give it up voluntarily. And then you have all these funny solutions coming up. You don't have technologies, you are very high carbon, and you're still using coal. Your products, when we import them into Europe, for example, we will put a tax because your product is not climate friendly and it's very high carbon content. Solutions taken out of a context or framework of equity then penalizes. Because without the finance and the technology that was promised to shift production into climate-friendly production, and then you penalize those same countries where millions of workers are engaged in producing those products by putting a simple thing called a tax, it's not going to solve the problem, but will increase the tensions. So a lot of these false solutions are now clashing with a growing call for climate justice and paradigm shift. Most of the government representatives are caught between the different vested interests. But there are those who are also fighting for that same change that we are talking about. And so the challenge is, how do we, as citizens groups, and especially as women's organizations in the movement, the two questions that we were asked to pose at the end of our presentation, how can we work for transformation and transition to sustainability within the framework of human rights, equity, and the ecological limits that are confronting us? How do we have cooperation and solidarity and not vicious competition? Secondly, how can we recapture the UN and multilateralism and all levels of governance from the stranglehold of profiteering and corporate greed? And how can we then restore power relations to a level of sanity? Thank you.
Shi Yokling from China, Programs Director of Third World Network. She addressed the 12th Annual AWID Forum in Istanbul in April 2012. Find more discussions at www.forum.awid.org. Thanks to FIRE, Feminist International Radio Endeavor, for providing the forum audio. Bea Bernhausen edited this program. To hear this and other WINGS programs again, email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.